If you talk about our climate, if you discuss our climate, then that makes you political. And I guess in the eyes of some anti-Bush, I'm not. I'm not even anti-war. Actually, I'm a libertarian, and I've been a libertarian for a long, long time now. So what I say isn't politically motivated. It never has been. 6 years ago, 6 years ago, Whitley and I published The Coming Global Superstorm. And I should add that years before that, I was talking about this. Then we published the book, and that was 6 years ago now. So just to put it all in perspective for you. Now, how many of you got to see 60 Minutes tonight? I asked you to watch it, so I would presume a good, probably, I don't know, healthy bunch of you got to see 60 Minutes, right? And James Hansen, the scientist who can't talk, talked, sort of. It was called Rewriting the Science. It was all about the White House rewriting the science. And oh my God, did they ever rewrite the science? Talk about redaction. I'm sorry, I know I shouldn't laugh, but it's, you gotta laugh or you'll cry. He is a very calm, very non-alarmist, best in his field. He said, you may, as somebody else said, you may find somebody as good, but you're not going to find anybody better than James Hansen. He's it. James Hansen is it. Top of NASA. Top of the climate modeling. And the 60 Minute story, I thought, laid it out superbly, elegantly, without political, tilt, in my opinion. They just laid it out. They showed you what the White House had changed. And if you're not angry as hell, then you weren't watching. It was an elegant story, to be sure. You know, so this is a many, many, many years, going on a decades project for me, trying to sound the alarm bells on this. And so I was very thankful to see the hard-hitting piece 60 Minutes did tonight. Hey, were you watching Matt Lauer? I wonder if Matt Lauer was watching. Somebody do me a favor and send a VCR tape or a DVD over to Matt Lauer, will you? Tell him, courtesy of Art Bell. I had a whole lot of email on the subject. This is just one I thought it'd be worth reading. It's from a gal, named Honey. There's a good name for you, Honey, huh? Or who writes, Art, the idiots are ruining our Earth, and just where do they think we're all going to go when the Earth decides it's not enough? I cannot say how brave, I just can't talk about how brave this man is for stepping forward, but we need to keep this in the public eye, or once again, the government will shove it back down under the rug. I truly believe they don't care, since, you see, in 10 years, most of these old men will be dead. But see, I have three granddaughters, so it upsets me greatly. Why are we allowing these men, who not only are waging war on other men, but ruining our very lives by waging war with the environment? As women, we should all be standing up and demanding change. We need a woman to run and win before there's nothing left to save. And here I am still staring at the story from yesterday called Climate Change Irreversible as Arctic Sea Ice Fails to Reform. They're talking about tipping points. And by the way, again, I'm going to be gone for a couple of weeks or so. And I'm going to do a little earth tipping myself, a little change of scenery, and we'll be right back. Tipping points. All right, you know what? For the next, at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to do something a little outrageous. I'm going to play the Rendlesham audio now. It's about 17 minutes long, so I'm not going to do it right now. Right now, I'd like people to call up and comment on the 60 Minutes piece. If you saw it and you're not ticked off, I don't know. So, I mean, if you want to dial in real quick, I'm going to take some calls on the 60 Minutes piece. But then at the bottom of the hour in 1980, we talked about it last night on the program, the Rendlesham affair. And it's one thing to talk about it. Let me tell you something. It's something else to hear it. And this was a military unit that went out to investigate a UFO, actually a smaller UFO, perhaps a remote-controlled craft of some sort, but definitely not of this Earth. And the audio at the very beginning is a little difficult to understand, but then it gets real good. And you, oh, man. At the end of the thing, they actually begin to see these objects, and it's pretty wild to hear, and I'm really surprised that nobody's ever played it for you, so I'm going to do that. I mean, we're talking about a military unit here. There's no question, as I listen to it and as you listen to it, it'll be obvious that Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hault and this military unit are encountering UFO evidence of a landing, and then they're encountering UFOs. And, it's on tape. It's recorded. So, yeah, I'm going to play it. What the hell? In fact, about a lot of things. Again, I'm a libertarian, but I have deep, deep abiding concerns, worries about what's going on with our climate. And I am now too old and been in this game too long to give a damn and not say what I believe. And what I believe is that we're headed for an unmitigated disaster if we don't start doing something about it. This is not Republican. It's not Democrat. It's not even libertarian. It's just science. And if we don't get off our butts and do something pretty quick, we're just going to be, well, it won't be us, will it? It'll be our children. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Art. Do you suppose it would be mechanically advantageous from the point of view of future Mars colonists to conjoin Mars's moon?
Okay, right now, sir, is your comment about the 60 Minutes piece?
Excuse me?
It's not, is it?
About the climate change?
Yes, uh-huh, because that's what I'm taking calls on right
well,
now.
Well, it is censorship. It is definitely censorship.
You saw the piece.
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh. Is there any other word that you could even think of that would apply other than censorship?
Hostile takeover is the word that comes to mind.
Hostile takeover. All right, thank you very much. I want to get as many comments as I can. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi. Hi, turn your radio off, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Oh, wow. Well,
did you see the 60 Minutes piece, sir?
I didn't see it, but I would like to comment on the fact that the scientists are being censored.
Yes.
I don't understand this is America. I just don't understand how they can do that.
Well,
us to stand for it.
It was America.
Oh, exactly. It was. But I mean, we're fighting for freedom. They love to say that.
That's a godforsaken thing to even say. This was America. But there was a time when our top scientists, the top scientist, whatever you think of him in climate, he's number one. And to have him muzzled, to have his words changed.
Certainly.
To the degree that it's changing the meaning that he's trying to get across to the world and to America. Well, that's just not American.
But I did read the CBS newsprint that you had on the webpage.
Good for you.
And it's very alarming. 10 years. That's.
And you know what? He might be being conservatives. What if it's 6 years? What if he is being conservative and it's 6 years? Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Rick from Rio Linda.
Yes, sir.
And that show on 60 Minutes tonight was just phenomenal.
Are you beginning now, sir, to see what I've been trying to say?
Well, Art, I've been listening to your program for many, many years, and the alarm bells are starting to go off. I listen to the BBC World News all the time on public radio.
Right.
And they're talking about it in Europe like nothing else.
I know.
I can only say one thing about our illustrious president sitting in Oval Office right now. The guy's an idiot.
Oh, well, see, I think that's wrong to say that. He's not an idiot. He's not. He's a Republican. He's a dedicated Republican. He believes what the party believes. And that just happens to be not what the science is. That's what's wrong with party politics. And see, the moment somebody like myself gets on the radio and does what I'm doing right now, all hell breaks loose. And as I told you earlier, I'm just too old to care. I've been doing this too long to give a damn one way or the other. Actually, I've been that way for years now. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, hello. Turn your radio off if it's on. If not, proceed.
Well, hello, Art.
Hi.
Hi. I did see the 60 Minutes program. By the way, this is David. I'm over in Southeast Virginia. And the term censorship, in my mind, it's not quite strong enough. When you consider that the person who rewrote some of those specific statements...
A lawyer.
He was a former lobbyist for the oil industry.
Actually, I believe they said that at the end of his tenure, didn't he go to work for an oil company?
I think he did.
I think that's what they said, yes.
Yes, I believe they said that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, are you concerned? Are you concerned that?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that you just might not be getting the truth, and that the planning that we should be doing because of what they say is happening—not might be happening, but is happening—that we ought to be doing something about it.
Well, of course, I think that the recent past shows us that we have to take preparations of our own.
Yes, indeed.
And do our own planning.
Yes.
But I don't think this is really new. That the story is being rewritten. What we're getting is
well, what's new is the fact that it's being rewritten on that scale, on the kind of scale that makes, you know, take something that they're saying, the scientists are saying is, and they're saying, well, not really. No, it isn't, or it could be, or it might be, or insufficient data, or whatever it is they added to change the meaning of the science reports.
That's right.
What kind of idiots are we? I mean, we're just idiots.
Well.
I mean, fine, let the White House meddle about, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, in things that bear on the party's welfare. You know, whoever sits in the White House, let them do that. But when they're meddling around in our world, in our future, in the future of our children, no. See, the editing, the redacting doesn't belong in those areas.
It's far beyond the Nero syndrome.
I appreciate the call. Thank you. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
For all the people that might not think that you're being partisan with the politics involving this, I'd like to say one need only to listen to past shows where you were critical of the Clinton administration and took him to task.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Took him apart.
Yes, you did. And I watched the show tonight as you recommended, and I thought that it was surprising that it was a lawyer, like you said before, that was doing the editing of the NASA scientist's report.
Hmm.
But I didn't find it surprising that he's now working for ExxonMobil, and that's all I had. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Have a good evening. A good future. I don't know how many of you took my advice and watched that, but if you're not ticked off, then I don't know. I guess you didn't take my advice. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey there, Art. How are you tonight?
I'm okay, sir.
And calling yourself? From Toronto. I just wanted to let you know that it wasn't on here, and we get our feed from Buffalo.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, then obviously you can't comment. But you get the gist, right?
Yeah. I turned it in specifically to watch it, and I was very disappointed not to hear it. It was a show. It was a thing on a football player, a country music singer, and I forget what else.
Oh, hey, that certainly is more important.
No, it isn't. But it's interesting that they didn't run it up here, and they did down there.
What do they call it up there? 3 minutes? Maybe four?
Maybe.
Thank you very much. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
East of the Rockies?
That'd be you, yes.
Yes, I'm calling from Duluth.
Duluth, Minnesota.
Yes.
Okay.
And I've listened to you forever, and I love you. Anyway,
that's a long time, forever.
Well, forever is a long time, but that's okay. I did watch on your advice. I normally don't watch 60 Minutes.
Yes.
And I was, I have been watching in the climate for years because my children, they're really old now, but they laugh at me and they say, Mom, you and the weather. Well, I've been watching and talking about it for 20 years to them, and you are so right on, but I don't know what we can do.
Oh, I don't either.
And I mean, I get frustrated.
But you know what? The one thing that we could begin doing is telling the American people the truth.
That is a first step.
This is still, anyway, down here, ma'am, it's America. And, you know, that's the barest of beginnings, is to tell the truth and not to lie about something that bears on the future of our own children. And
or even some of us.
Even some of us, yes.
That are still going to be around in 40 years, we hope. Anyway, another thing about the current administration, and, you know, I don't like to call our sitting president or any president names because that doesn't get you anywhere.
No, it doesn't.
But EPA, they had a lot of reports changed, and I don't know if people have followed that as far as air quality goes.
Yes.
Just have come out of the White House. It was interesting about the scientist who did quit because he disagreed, but he said if you want to keep your job, you don't say anything. I thought that was an interesting point, too.
Sure. All of this is potentially career-ending, you know, for these guys. And
right.
So you got to respect them. And, you know, as he said, you don't speak out until either you retire or you get angry and you quit or, you know, something. Otherwise, you know, I've been trying to say this for years. People have families. They have children. They have income they have to have. So I understand.
Right. And my father says sometimes, and my mother, he says, why don't people rise up like they did 200 years ago? And she says, Bob, they can't. They've got to feed their families. They were agriculture before they could sustain themselves. Now they can't.
Right.
So, same thing.
I kind of agree with Honey here, who wrote to me.
What did Honey say?
Honey said, you know, basically we need a woman in the White House. And, you know, that's kind of a good idea.
Well, I think, you know, even though they say we're all equals, we do look at things a little differently.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. And I really think it's time we got a woman in the White House. Not Hillary for my taste, thank you, but a woman.
Well, it would be, you know, we've had all other kinds of people. Why not try a woman, huh?
Let's get Gina. So, some people will understand that. All right. You have a good night.
You too.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, Art.
Yes, yes, yes.
Good to speak with you and finally speak with you after about 3.5 years or more.
My
name is Ricardo from San Francisco.
Yes.
I used to speak with you about your back all the time and other things.
Oh, yes,
Yeah, and you told me I should be in front of Congress answering questions once about UFOs and actually giving an answer to their questions.
I'm going to do UFOs here in a minute. But
yes, on this issue, it is extremely important to go back to stories that were out initially around February 9th on this George Douche, the man, Douche, who is a NASA official, and the other official, Dean Acosta, who was the press secretary when they were finally talking about James Hansen, and how many other scientists have been mothballed at this point. After I see stories on this issue from February, I've seen them from March 19th and going back to March 3rd.
Sir, doesn't this stuff make you angry?
Well, according to, I remember the quickening and what you've always talked about. And
yes.
I've listened to you for so many years.
Yes.
And Linda Moulton Howe, who I've spoken to on innumerable times about these issues.
Yes.
And it just keeps welling and welling and welling into a planetary catastrophe. And that's why people should really tune in and figure out what the ominous parallels are with government and censorship and the amount of what's turning this country into something other than this free republic we call America.
I remember when I started doing a talk show long ago, and people used to make the kind of statements that you just made, and I would go, oh, come on, it's it may be a lot of things, but it's still America. Now, you know, now, I don't know, maybe that sentiment fits, and man, that's one sad thing to contemplate, that, you know, it's not America, not the America we knew. This will chill you, I promise. Hold on. Get close to the radio. Turn the volume up a little bit, because coming up, I don't think you've ever, ever heard this. 26 years ago. You know, I take my own program seriously. Bentwaters occurred 26 years ago in 1980. And last night, it was a kick butt show. I hope you got to hear it. If you didn't, go back and listen to the archives, about Bentwaters. Now, listen to me carefully. What you're about to hear is Rendlesham. Now, this is a military unit, that responded, and they're out in the forest, in Rendlesham, and it's obviously a military unit. Now, after we talked about it on the show last night, I said, my God, there's a tape of this. And he said, yes, oh yes. And so, as I say, I take my own show seriously. I went on the web immediately after the program and listened. I went, oh my God. You know, it's like the audience has got to hear this. Now, the first part of it's going to be difficult to hear, but then it'll begin to sort of clear up, and you'll get used to listening to it after a moment. What I'd like you to do is kind of curl around your radio and listen very carefully, because, again, you're going to hear a military unit responding to a UFO landing report, finding some physical evidence, and then, oh my God, at the end, they're going to actually see them themselves. You're also going to hear them taking a Geiger counter reading. So, I mean, this is dramatic stuff. It's about 17 minutes. Here it is. 26 years ago, here's what happened.
150 feet or more from the initial, I should say, suspected impact point. Having a lift going, we can't get the light all to work. There seems to be some kind of mechanical problem. Let's send back another light. Income, we're going to take some readings with the Geiger counter and chase around here a little bit, wait for another light off to muck in. Okay, we're now approaching the area within about 25, 30 feet. What kind of readings we get? Anything? Just minor clicks. Reading impressions.
One.
Is that all bigger than they are?
Well, there's one more well.
The security control. We're still getting clicks.
Yes, sir. We're now on the 5-10 scale, and we're reading about 3rd, 4th increment.
Okay, we're still comfortably safe here.
Do you have a light on? Full gas ready? I can read that. The meter's definitely giving a little pulse. Hey, guys, that's what I was going to say. Let's go to the center of the area next and see what kind of reading we get out there. You're reading the clicks. I can't hear the clicks.
Yes, sir.
That about the center, Bruce?
Yes.
Okay, let's go to the center.
Yes, I'm getting
it. That's the best deflection needle I've seen yet. Okay, can you give me an estimation? We're on the 0.5 scale. We're getting
approximately 0125 hours.
We're getting right at a half of a meter right now. Last point. I haven't seen it go any higher. Okay, we'll go out toward the...
Now it's picking up.
This is out toward the number one indentation where we first got the strongest reading. Yeah, it's similar to what we got in the center.
Not in a pod. This might be in a center.
This looks like an area here, possibly. It could be a blast.
It's in the center.
That's hard to tell. You've got to take some fingers by the fringe.
Here's two.
Up to what, 7?
What?
Just jumped up to 7/10 there.
7/10 right here in the center?
Uh-huh. We found a small blast, what looks like a blasted or scrubbed up area here. We're getting very positive readings. Let's see, is that here the center?
Yes, it is. This is what
we would assume would be the dead center.
Just making up for us to go along the whole area now.
Up to 7/10? seven units, it's called, on a 0.5 scale. Okay, why don't we do this? Why don't we make a sweep?
Here, I've got my gloves on now. Let's make a sweep out around the whole area, about 10 foot out, and make a perimeter run around it, starting right back here at the corner, back at the same first corner where we came in. Let's go right back here. Don't let the pendulum on you counting the clicks.
Right.
Okay, let's visit. Then
yes,
I can put the light on it and sweep around it.
It was flat.
Put it on the ground every once in a while.
This looks like an abrasion on the tree.
Okay, we'll catch that on the way back. Let's go around. Hold back. Hit it there.
Got any interest right over here? It looks like an abrasion pointing into the center.
It is. It may be old though. There's some snap marks or something on it. Let's go on back around. All right.
So it gives some extension.
Yeah, this is an awkward thing to use, isn't it?
I don't see how I can carry it on my ears, but this one broke.
Further, I'm going to shut the recorder off till we find something.
Pick it up?
What are we up to? We're up to 2-3 units. Deflection, you're getting in close to one pod.
Picking up something here. Picking up.
Okay, it's still not going above 3 or 4 units.
Picking up more though. More frequent.
Yes, you're staying steady up around 2 to 3 to 4 units now. Yeah.
Each one of these trees that face into the blast, what we assume is a landing site, all have an abrasion facing in the same direction towards the center. The same
That's interesting. Well, let's go this way around the circle here. Turn it back down here.
Picking up collection.
Let me see that. Well, that's kind of funny. That's you're right about the abrasion. I've never seen a tree that's never seen a pine tree that's been damaged react that fast.
I got a bottle to put that in.
Yeah, you got a sample bottle?
Yes, sir.
Yes, for the soil.
Here, sit this on the ground. Okay, from now on, let's identify that as point number one. That's staked there. So you all know where it is. We have to sketch it. You got that, Sir Nevels?
Yes, sir.
Closest to the wood bridge base.
Be point one.
And let's go clockwise from there.
Point two.
So this tree is between point two.
Two other personnel requesting to find that location.
Tell them negative at this time. We'll tell them when they can come out here. We don't want them out here right now.
Okay, the sample, you're going to mark this sample number one.
Yes.
Have them cut it off and include some of that sap and all. Is between indentation 2 and 3 on a pine tree about 5 feet away, about 3.5 feet off the ground. There's a round abrasion on the tree about 3.5-4 inches in diameter. It looks like it might be old, but strange as a crystalline pine sap has come out that fast. See, there's other trees here that are damaged in similar fashion.
Yes, so I'll make
it toward the center of the landing site.
Okay, why don't you take a picture of that and remember your picture, and you got to be writing this down. Well, it's going to be on the tape.
I've got a tape measure with you.
This is the picture. Your first picture will be at the first tree, the one between mark 2 and 3. Meantime, I'm going to look at a couple of these trees over here.
We are getting some.
You're getting rains on the tree you're taking samples from on the side facing the suspected landing site.
4 clicks max.
Up to 4. Interesting. That's right where you're taking the sample now. 4. That's the strongest point on the tree?
Yes, sir. If you come to the back, there's no clicks whatsoever.
No clicks at all on the back. It's all on the
maybe
side
one,
facing the... Interesting. The indentations look like something twisted as it got, you know, as it sat down on them. Looks like someone took something and sat it down and twisted it from side to side.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange. We're looking at the same tree we took the sample off with this, what do you call it, star scope?
Star
scope. Getting a definite heat reflection off the tree, about 3 to 4 feet off the ground?
Yes, where the spot is.
Same place where the spot is. We're getting a heat
spot on a tree directly behind us. I picked up the same thing, one off to your right.
Three trees in the area, immediately adjacent to the site, within 10 feet of the suspected landing site. We're picking up heat reflection off the trees.
Like five and up.
What's that again?
Shine the light on again, Bob.
Well, you have trouble here.
Yeah,
give them right on the spot, and then when you want them, okay,
turn
the
light on.
Light,
you'll notice the white.
Hey. You're right. There's a white streak on the tree.
It indicates.
Let me turn around at this tree over here now. Just a second. White streak right on the tree. I can see it. Wait a minute, give me a little side lighting so I can climb the tree. Okay, off.
Alpha 2 security.
I lost the tree. Okay, stop, stop. Light off. Hey, this is eerie.
What is the hot spot?
This is strange. Here, someone want to look at the spots in the ground? Whoops, watch your nose. We're walking all over the park here,
sir.
Okay, let's step back, not walk all over. Come back here, somebody put a beam on him. But you're going to have to be back 10 or 15 feet. You see it?
Okay, fine.
Okay, lights off.
He took this long to dock.
What do you think about the spot? Is it back again?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that's the flashlight, sir. This
pull that to the edge of the clearing so I can get a better look at it. See if you can get the star scope on it. The light's still there, and all the barnyard animals have gotten quiet now. Yeah, we're heading about 110 to 120 degrees from the site out through to the clearing now. Still getting a reading on the meter. About 2 clicks. Maybe we count 3 to 4 clicks, getting stronger.
Now it's coming up. Hold up. There we go. About approximately 4 foot off the ground. It's come to set to 110 degrees.
All right, just turn the meter off. Gotta say that again. About 4 feet off the ground, about 110 degrees, getting a reading of about 4 clicks.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, but
it's done.
I think it's something other than the ground. I think it's something that's something valuable here.
The tree right over.
We just found the first night bird we've seen. We're about 150 or 200 yards from the site. Everything else is just deathly calm. There is no doubt about it. There's some type of strange flashing red light ahead.
There's yellow.
I saw a yellow tinge in it, too. Weird. It appears that he may be moving a little bit this way. Yes, it's brighter than it has been.
Yellow.
It's coming this way.
Also,
it is definitely coming this way. Pieces of it are shooting off. There is no doubt about it. This is weird.
To the left.
Yeah, definitely moving.
Two lights. One light to the front,
okay.
One light to the left.
Keep the flashlights off. There's something very, very strange. Keep the headset on. See if it gets any stronger. Okay. Give us your radar.
I have a notation that this is on a beta reading, too.
It's on a beta reading?
Beta
okay.
Still has been removed.
Okay. This is falling off it again.
But it just moved to the right.
Yeah.
Off to the right.
Strange. Oh, well, why don't you go left? Let's approach to the edge of the woods up there. Can you undo it out lights? Let's do it carefully. Come on. Okay, we're looking at the thing. We're probably about 200 to 300 yards away. It looks like an eye winking at you. It's still moving from side to side. And when you put the star scope on it, it sort of has a hollow center, a dark center. It's like a pupil of an eye looking at you and winking. And the flash is so bright to the star scope that it almost burns your eye. We passed the farmer's house and across in the next field. Now we have multiple sightings of up to 5 lights with a similar shape and all, but they seem to be steady now rather than a pulsating or glow with a red flash. We just crossed the creek. And we're getting what kind of readings now? Getting 3 good clicks on the meter, and we're seeing strange lights in the sky. At 2:44, we're at the far side of the second farmer's field, and made sighting again about 110 degrees. This looks like it's clear out to the coast. It's right on the horizon. Moves about a bit and flashes from time to time. Still steady or red in color. Also, after negative readings in the center of the field, we're picking up the slight readings, 4 or 5 clicks now on the meter. 3:05, we see strange strobe-like flashes to the rather sporadic, but there's definitely something, some kind of phenomenon. 3:05, at about 10 degrees horizon directly north, we've got 2 strange objects, half-moon shape, dancing about with colored lights on them. But guess to be about 5 to 10 miles out, maybe less. The half moons are now turning into full circles. As though there was an eclipse or something there for a minute or two. 3:15, now we've got an object about 10 degrees directly south, 10 degrees off the horizon. And the ones in the north are moving, one's moving away from us.
Moving out fast.
Not a thing in the world I can add to that. As real as a heart attack. That was from Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hall. Absolutely real. So if you want to deny it, then probably you ought to be like an editor at the White House or something. Incredible. Coming up, Professor James McCanney, MS, is a physicist who has now spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. He has openly opposed NASA's view that outer space is electrically neutral. McCanney was a faculty member of the physics and mathematics departments of Cornell University, Ithaca, New York. He has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics. For the layman, that would be studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space, and has presented his theories at Los Alamos National Labs and the American Geophysical Union. That would certainly seem to qualify him, wouldn't it? James McCanney, in a moment. This is obviously going to be interesting. James McCanney, welcome back to the program. How you doing, James?
Art, very good. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. I understand that you might want to open by talking about a couple of books. Your idea, not mine. Those books are what?
Oh, the coming global superstorm.
That book.
Which you might be a little familiar with there.
I've heard of it.
And then the Principia Meteorologia, the physics of sun-earth weather. That's my latest book, which I released 2005 September on Coast to Coast, and we're going to talk about some Earth changes, but in a different context than what people had possibly heard before.
Well, before we switch contexts, did you happen to catch 60 Minutes tonight?
No,
Oh, what a shame!
I missed it.
Oh, gee, what a shame! It was so very interesting, about the climate, and, there was so much. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. You're essentially then, as a virgin, going to talk about this anyhow. So, there is a lot going on right now with our climate, and finally, it's being acknowledged. You just think that it's coming from a different source, right?
Well, there are many factors, and, one of the things that, I'm starting to say is that we have to stop quibbling over some of this scientific theoretical stuff. And, of course, that's important. But I believe that global warming is inevitable. We're seeing it. We can't reverse it. And I think one of the biggest myths is that if somehow in 10 years we stop CO2 emissions or something, that we're going to reverse what's going on.
Well, James Hansen seems to think there's at least a chance. I don't think there's a chance that we'll actually stop, and whether it would make any difference or not is probably academic. I mean, the change is upon us, in my opinion. That's just my opinion.
Oh, that's exactly right. I'm real familiar with Hansen and his work and the NASA silencing him. So if that's what
it was all about that. Actually, what they showed on the program, James, was the stuff that was actually redacted, and it was not trivial. I mean, it changed the entire report, the power and the importance of the report, which is going to affect every single person on the planet. It literally changed the meaning of it, James. And in America, that's not right.
Oh, well, I've been talking about this, and of course, in the general science, space science sense, for a long time, that NASA has been controlling its scientists. And tonight we'll probably talk about cometary topics. The same issue is going on, where if you don't march the party line, you don't talk. It's very controlled.
You know, you wouldn't think science, James, would be the place where there'd be party lines. Science, what is science?
Well,
it is a search for truth, right? It's
absolutely
for facts. It's for absolutes. In science, you have absolutes.
And you have experimental methods, which are tried and true, which are not personality-dependent or bias-dependent. And you create experiments which people can duplicate elsewhere.
It should be beyond politics.
Right.
Completely beyond politics, but apparently not.
That but in there is a big one. And it's so odd that NASA is, nobody has gotten more funding to study global warming than NASA, and now they're reversing their stance on it. So because it's politically correct with the current regime.
Well, I'm not sure they're reversing their stance. What's happening is their stance is getting rewritten. So that's not NASA's fault. Hansen's one brave guy, in my opinion, very brave. Anyway, look, let's for a second, let's talk about comets. I mean, you and I have talked about comets. Traditionally, science has thought, as astronomers have thought, they were big, dirty snowballs. And, you know, in all the interviews we've done over the years, James, you have maintained it ain't true. So, like, they sent this satellite up to capture comet dust, and we'll talk about the advisability of doing that in the first place, but they actually caught some comet dust and they brought it back. Isn't that true?
Correct.
So the argument should be over. Because we've got actual comet stuff, right?
Oh, absolutely. They should have found water and little dust particles and things that formed in the coldest environment. Mm-hmm. And that's not what they found. In fact, I get input from people, many who are not scientists, and one of the most interesting was that somebody was reading this and said, you know, they never talked about finding any water. Or any ice particles.
All right, so exactly, I mean, a lot of people in the audience don't know, and I'm included, what the hell did they find?
Well, they found what are known as CAIs.
What are those?
Those are calcium aluminum in, what are the
calcium, calcium and aluminum?
Yeah, and they are formed under extreme high temperatures, and then they found other materials that were,
most of the time, if you boil water, usually you don't get aluminum, do you?
No, in a composite form with other materials. So these are little, like, micro pebbles. Of minerals.
Pebbles of minerals.
That you would find, for example, in volcanic area or something like that. In the,
well, it still doesn't sound like water.
No, and it doesn't sound like dust. And they know that this did not form in a cold environment of outer space.
So what did they say? Well, there was water there, but, you know, it evaporated?
Well, and that's the thing also, that in taking photographs of these comet nuclei, they've been next to Halley's nucleus back in 86. They thought it would be white and snowy and very little dust. And it turns out to be the blackest object in the solar system. And
son of a gun.
And on Comet Bild, which is the one that the Stardust mission went by. And then Comet Borealy, they've photographed that one. And then now the Comet Temple 1, which they actually crashed into.
See, if this actually came from the White House, it would have said, might have gone by. Conceivably could have gone by.
And we believe it.
But there's still sufficient doubt about whether it actually went by.
Right. Even though we have photos, we can deny them at a later date. It's amazing. They have, in fact, the point is they haven't found any water or ice of any kind on a comet nucleus. And
isn't that embarrassing?
Well, they found it in the tail, so they keep saying, well, it's got to be coming from the nucleus. And what I keep saying is, no, it's being pulled into the nucleus, and these small comets are too warm to maintain it, so that water just gets funneled back out into the comet tail region as in the form of neutrals. And that's a term, a cometary science term, for a neutral atom or molecule that is then flowing back out in the solar wind. So it's kind of a cycling process, but when they crashed into Temple 1 this past July 4th, a couple things. The entire surface, well, out of the exploded area of the crater, they found chemicals and organic chemicals and other types of dust and other materials, but no water. And they were expecting that the water must be just right under the surface. Well,
let me ask you a question, James. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
I'm just curious. They advertised this ahead of time as a big July 4th, you might even see it with your own eyes kind of deal. I guess they figured they were going to crash into the snowball and split it into 50 million pieces, and there was going to be this incredible sky show that people on Earth could see. Well, that didn't seem to happen. So does that give credence to what you're saying? I mean, they didn't.
Well, that part, it was just a bit harder than they thought. They did have a pretty good plume of material coming out of the crater.
Well, it was fair. I mean, the spacecraft there that was taking the photographs, that was impressive, but it wasn't visible from Earth. It wasn't
no.
that big.
No, No, and in fact, the most powerful telescopes could see a brightening, but then again, they saw brightenings the day before also when was going on.
Yeah. So it seems to me that kind of bears on your case a little bit. In other words, the magnitude or the lack of it.
Right. And the spectrometer data was finally released just about a month ago from the Deep Impact. In fact, George and Richard Hoagland and myself were on July 4th waiting for this data.
Yes.
And we're all with our jaws on the ground when NASA said, well, we're not going to release the spectrometer data, which is the most important data, because that tells you the composition, the temperature.
Well, no, wait. Well, why did they not release that?
Well, we now know why, because at first they said, well, we don't know if it was pointed in the right direction. Well, we already knew something was amiss. And, of course, it was pointed in the right direction because it points based on the cameras, and they had all the photographic imagery. So why would the spectrometer not be pointed in the right direction?
Well, see, actually, maybe it was pointed at somebody's career.
Well, they, of course, had to wait for the proper way to release the data. And this is somewhat like Hansen and his greenhouse. Data. But ultimately, when it was released, the comet nucleus was too hot to support water, and they actually had to make that statement that the temperature of the nucleus in outer space was so hot that water in any form could not exist on that nucleus.
Well, now, that seems like
a smoking gun?
Well, it seems like something, a choking gun is what I'd call it. I mean, didn't they choke when they had to say that?
Well, yes, and then the spectrometer data, which actually got to view the whole nucleus over the course of the passage, was able to identify, it examined the entire surface. Only 25 one-thousandths of 1% of the nucleus, that's a small amount,
sure is.
Had any trace of water at all.
Oh, my.
And so, just to give perspective, of the 45 square miles of surface area of this comet nucleus of Tempel 1, only about 6 football fields in size had any trace of water at all, and that was just a trace which was mixed in with some surface dust, and it was not belching out and forming the tail.
Well, James, doesn't this explode some careers?
Well, this past month, much to my surprise, I was walking by a TV monitor, and the History Channel was airing a TV show, a special just made, called Comets, Prophets of Doom, where all the NASA entourage of comet scientists were on, telling how this explained the Dirty Snowball Comet model. and I thought, now I hadn't heard that term for about 2 years.
Yes.
In the media, they were talking about these icy bodies and on and on, but they never used that term. And all of a sudden, out of the woodwork came that special. Then the Thursday morning after, the BBC released an article on this Stardust result called "Comets Are Born of Fire and Ice," and that got wide coverage. And it came from the LA Times. It was reprinted in all the national newspapers. Explaining these icy objects from the distant solar system also have some hot stuff in them.
Can you objectively tell me how they made their argument based on the data we just talked about, that they are indeed dirty snowballs? How did they do that, James?
Well, they said it's a mystery, and they decided that there is something called the X-wind, which they didn't believe in before, that somehow this X-wind, I'm not sure why they didn't call it the Z-wind or the Y-wind, but supposedly they
claimed the Y-wind would have been good.
I think so.
Why?
I like that better.
Yeah.
But but they claimed that possibly early in the formation of the solar system that these particles were formed near our sun or possibly another one and then catapulted out to where they formed with the comets.
Ah.
And so now we have a formed over here, flew over there, and it kind of rings of what they criticized Velikovsky for, for that stuff that just kind of flew around the solar system with no physical means of support, visible means of support, so to speak. And also with these, they've talked about Z winds and X winds and a thing called the T-Tauri wind, which they believed was a high gaseous wind coming off the protostar early in the formation of the solar system.
Sounds like there was a lot of gaseous wind.
Art. Well, it's
just trying to help you.
Yes, I appreciate that. But the big question now to me is, why are they riding this extinct dinosaur and bringing it back? That is the big question. We've talked about this before in the air. Why are they? I believe that there was sufficient data that I had in like 79 when I happened to be at Cornell. I felt there was plenty of data at that time to conclusively say that the Dirty Snowball Comet model couldn't possibly be true. And now we have all of this piled on top of it, and they are still sticking to their story.
Why is science, which should be a seeker of facts and a reviser when necessary of data, you know, admitting that, well, okay, here's the truth, because science is the search for truth. So, I mean, what's going on here, James?
It's bizarre. That's the only word I can put on it. And what I find amazing also is in this Comets, Prophets of Doom 2-hour special on the History Channel, all of these scientists have put their John Henry on this model. And for posterity, this is after all the data's in. And so, you know, in 100, 200 years when the pendulum finally swings the other way and the people figure out that the moon is not made out of green cheese, these people all have their face and name and, you know, all chatting about the Dirty Snowball Comet model and how it's been confirmed. And, you know, so I wouldn't want to be personally in that position for all of the notoriety and fame and free vacations that these scientists get.
Once again, James McKinney. Welcome back, James.
Thank you, Art.
So then, comets are not at all what they're suggesting, but you would describe them not as dirty. Well, how would you describe them as what?
Well, the term I use is the plasma discharge comet and model. And what that means is that comets are basically any rock or item that could be a microscopic piece of material. It could be something the size of Jupiter. And, in fact, all the planets are discharging what I call the solar capacitor. And objects in elliptical orbits...
Wait.
Discharge...
No, stop.
Oop.
Stop. I want to understand that. Discharging the solar capacitor. Comets are doing that? Planets are doing that? Discharging the solar capacitor, do you mean our sun?
Well, the sun, it turns out, puts out an excess of positive current, primarily in the way of protons and ions, pushing out in the solar wind,
and it
forms a capacitor that is far beyond Pluto, with the positive side being out there, and the relative negative sun in the center.
Yeah, we have this big solar wind that whips by and causes solar storms and all that stuff. So, yeah, that's true. The sun does that. Now, what are you saying, though, that comets...
That there are localized potentials in this, and then also the overall capacitor, which is way out there. And it's kind of like that backyard bug zapper that people see when the bug flies in between the grid plates. The electrical discharge occurs in the path of the bug.
Okay, and so in our case, we're thinking of the bug as the comet, right?
As any object in that path, and so when an object comes in or is in an elliptical orbit, it's cutting down through the potential gradient of that electric field.
Okay, James.
And discharges it.
Is there any validity, then, in your opinion, to the fact that comets are regarded as sort of prophets of doom and of change and of, you know, it's a very, very old, I mean, people would look and see comets and they'd go, oh, my God, something big is going to happen. Is there a practical reason for that old, well, I don't want to say myth?
Well, in fact, it is a myth, and it comes, a lot of our mythology of the ancient Greeks comes down from the fact that the planets were fighting, and that's what Velikovsky is all about, that he wrote about what the ancients saw.
Yeah, except that I'm saying maybe it isn't really a myth.
No.
A myth is just sort of an old thing that was said, but I mean, it has reason to be said, right? And what is that reason?
Well, the reason is because we have not in historic or scientific times seen these big comets. So scientists deny that they could exist. Yet the ancient history and every ancient text that I see talks about comets. The legends from around the world all talk about the comets, and they have various names for them. The Zephyr, the Thunderbolt down in your neck of the woods there, and the Egyptians had theirs. The Quetzalcoatl is the Mayan, Inca, and Aztec version of the plumed serpent.
Right.
God of the night sky, and the Mayans talk about a specific one, Quetzalcoatl, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus.
Yes, sir.
And so the whole issue here is, number one, comets are not dirty snowballs. They are a plasma discharge of this solar capacitor.
Mm-hmm.
And the big ones, if captured properly, and this is not a normal, a frequent event to create a moon or a planet, but it can happen, and statistically, it over the course of the solar system, we only have 9 planets, so clearly it's not something that happens every day.
Okay, for example, I interviewed the Hopi elders, and they firmly believe that in the past, comets have been portenders of change, and that, in fact, when they look into the future, James, they see comets coming and then monstrous Earth changes occurring.
Right.
Do they have a basis in reality for believing this, James, is what I'm getting at again?
Absolutely.
And there you go, folks.
Once again, it comes down from all the nations of the world. In fact, just looking at the fact that we have this segmented population of races, we would call them, of people from all over the world who obviously many were in communication at one time with other parts of the world, and there were vast worldwide civilizations at one time. And
well,
now,
there had to be, James. Otherwise, how would you have these pyramids all over the globe?
Oh, yeah, and you find pyramids in Tikal or whatever that are just like the ones in Southeast Asia.
All over the place. And so the world was, that you can't just skip by that, the world was in communication.
Right.
Everything we thought about the old world has got to be wrong.
The whole evolution of man, the story that they came out of the cradle of civilization and somehow walked around the Bering Strait and then came down and populated the South American continent is, it just can't be true. There are cities they're unearthing right now in Peru, along the coastline, that they believe housed about 40 million people, some of the cities. And they're simply gone. There's no trace of a bone, very few potsherds, but very advanced. What they do find is very exquisite artwork, but simply gone.
40 million people.
Living
now,
in a city along the west coast of what is now Peru.
Fine. Try and explain to me, James, if you can. I've always wanted to know how a civilization, for example, ours right now, could in, I don't know, less than a million years, certainly, just disappear and not leave, really, a trace. I mean, nothing. I mean, you've got to explain that because you're saying it happened.
Right. And what happened was a vast ocean wave, which they also talk about, that Quetzalcoatl took the ocean up on his back and brought it over the land, which are the vast tidal waves generated by the large gravitational wave when one of these objects comes by.
Ah.
And, there have been events in the past where Earth has been hit by things, but in most of the cases, these objects come by and they do a great deal of damage without hitting directly. I call it action at a distance. We have the the mountain building, the tears in the planetary surface. The ancients are very clear that Mars at one time was a blue planet, was a water planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was relieved of its atmosphere and oceans by one of the large comets.
Can you imagine that? Entire oceans and a whole atmosphere just gone.
Gone. And they could see it, and that's one of the reasons they talk about the snake image, because as that extension, that plasma extension came off the comet coming by, reached out and grabbed Mars, it looked like a snake because the auroras around the planet looked like the snake's mouth as the serpent had the planet in its grasp, and they could see it go from a blue planet to the red planet we see today.
And here we have this red planet beginning to yield signs of underground water. Some of the most puzzling photographs have come back from Mars. I mean, photographs showing erosion and where great amounts of water had been running. And so here we sit on Earth on our nice little green and blue planet, just beautiful, sparkling. And you got to think, folks, it happened to Mars. They had oceans. They had atmosphere. And phew, it was gone.
It was gone.
If that happened here...
Well, it actually probably has happened on Earth in the past.
But I mean, if it happened now.
Could it happen now?
Or just if it did happen now, would we all have time to say, damn? Or, you know, how if it happened, how much time would we have?
Well, these things happen very quickly because the exchange, the encounter lasts, the direct encounter lasts probably less than a month as these things move in proximity in outer space. And it turns out that we did have two encounters with that same comet, according to the legends, the Quetzalcoatl or Venus comet, what Velikovsky calls the Venus comet. And we were bigger. Our surface gravity of Earth is larger than that of Venus. And oddly enough, the surface gravity of Venus is greater than that of Mars. So in the tug of war over Mars's atmosphere, Venus won. And in the tug of war over atmospheres when Venus came by Earth, Earth won. And we had a large pollution event. They talk about the rain of naphtha, the black blood that came from the sky, some of it burning as the brimstone and hail of brimstone and fire came in. This is in all of the old texts, in the legends and the Hopi elders. They all talk about this. They talk about the severe winds. And so, like in my weather book, I have a chapter on biblical weather. And I've learned a lot just from studying what the ancients went through and understanding that our weather is driven by electrical currents of electrical activity in the solar system and not by just the warmth of the sun from solar light.
Could be.
So
part of what somebody would call, no doubt, a cycle.
Right. And these are not frequent events. So if somebody says, well, is it going to happen soon? Unless you see one of these coming, then there's no way to predict if it'll be this week or in 100 years or
a million. Yeah, there really isn't. But you know what, James? I feel like biblical weather is coming.
Well, exactly. And your book clearly had an impression on a few people.
A few.
The movie was
The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, it certainly rose the awareness of people.
Certainly did.
And what I keep saying too is that we can somewhat.
Hey, you know who really loved that movie?
Who?
Rush. Boy, I tell you, he just loved that movie. He talked about it every day for a while.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, go ahead, James. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but the point is, we can maybe have some differences on theoretical about this or that or what may cause it, but we're in a very dynamic, changing solar system. The electrical nature, that's what I keep harping on, is the meteorologists don't have a handle on the electrical component of this weather system. But be that as it may...
Well, of course, they don't have much of a grasp of their own science. I mean, how accurate is weather forecasting?
Well, and that's the problem. If you had all the factors and the best supercomputers in the world, you'd probably do a little better.
I think it's great. It's where you can be wrong most of the time and still draw your paycheck and smile. It's a good job.
That's it's a good job. I want that job. What we're seeing, what I believe is happening is that what I keep talking about is the many Planet X objects. We talk about this term Planet X.
Yes.
And that's been a huge mess of misinformation and all kinds of things. But there are objects out there that we don't know much about. They're discovering new planets all the time. And we have many. I just gave a little lecture about a week ago.
Can I stop you again for a second?
Yeah.
You know, Planet X is irresistible to ask about. And so here's my question, James. If there was a dark planet out there, and by that I mean dark, just dark, dark-colored planet out there, and it was actually headed toward us, honestly, can you tell me about when you think our astronomers, amateur or pro, would detect the fact that, oh, my God, look, something planetary in size is headed toward us, but it's dark. How quickly would they catch that, James?
Well, actually, take our moon, for example, which looks white and very bright.
Yes, it does.
If you went up to the surface of the moon, it would be extremely black.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good example of something that is a good absorber of light, yet looks very bright. The problem with these objects, in, when they come in the outer solar system, when they would be very faint and maybe just the best telescopes would start to pick them up, first of all, you have to be looking in the right direction.
That's important.
But second of all, immediately they start to discharge the solar capacitor and they become enshrouded in a cloud of dust and gas.
Ah.
And that blocks the sunlight from reaching them. And NASA has actually built a telescope. I understand the funding has been canceled now. But it was to look for large diffuse clouds of gases and dust at the far reaches of the solar system, which would encapsulate one of these objects. And so in the background, I believe they are very much in agreement with what I've been talking about, because they're actually building the equipment to go out and look for these.
Well, what if we found one that was headed more or less toward us? And, of course, that would be the hardest to see, I suppose, you know, headed more or less right at us.
Right. And, in fact, it actually happened in the 90s. You remember Hale-Bopp?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, but I'm talking about, Hale-Bopp was big, but I'm talking about something
humongous.
Planetary size.
Let's stick with
Planet X for a second.
Right.
If there were one headed that was going to make a close pass, enough to do earth-changing, devastating type events to us, I'm just asking how quickly we would find it.
Well, it would certainly rear its ugly head once it got into, say, around the region of Pluto. It would become a large comet, and at that point, mostly everybody would probably see it.
Okay.
And you would see this thing up there, but...
And we'd have how long?
And you mean before we realized it coming even closer to us?
Well, by the time everybody noticed it, we would have how long before it did its thing by us?
It could be a number of years. And it depends on its orbit. See, orbits are strange things. Now, when the Quetzalcoatl-Venus comet was captured by Jupiter, according to the legends and what we can put together, it was captured by Jupiter, and that's when they first noticed that Venus was born of Jupiter, the old mythology of where Venus came from. And it was probably 600 years before it migrated in and circularized spiraled in, so to speak, to where it came in through Mars and then towards Earth.
Okay, well, I'm still stuck back on years. You said it could be years. So, in other words, the human race could find out that here comes this thing that's going to pass very close to Earth, probably causing an extinction of life on Earth. My next question is, something of that size, planetary size, James, what would be the chances of our diverting it?
Zero.
We would have zero chance of diverting.
These are
and
big.
We would have several years of notice. There would be a party unlike anybody has ever seen that would go on for that many years.
But the other possibility is this thing would be coming in at some kind of a super speed.
Oh.
And we might not detect it until maybe weeks before.
Short party.
Short party. Short spring break there.
What do you think How do you think the Earth's population would react to a inevitable, absolute extinction, unavoidable event?
It would be pretty bonkers, I believe. I think it would just go crazy. And see, this is why I think they keep promoting this ice ball charade, is so that when something appears up there in the form of a comet, they'll just go, oh,
yeah,
that's one of those little ice ball things. Don't worry about that.
So in other words, do you think they would conclude, James, that the result of such an inevitable absolute announcement would, I don't know, it would cause such disruption as to not be actually worth telling the people? So an extinction level event would be kept secret as long as, until it happened.
Right. The only thing we know is that the people, there are a lot of people preparing for such events, and they have cave cities and well-stocked. And somebody's been doing a lot of preparing, including NASA.
My guest is James McCanney, and he's just causing all kinds of trouble. So, you know, I wasn't ready for that answer, James. You know, you say it as though with some conviction, like they know something's coming, or they're just being prudent, or what?
Well, we saw this machine. It was actually the bit of the tunnel drilling device that came into Duluth, Minnesota, on an airport, on an aircraft that was the only one in the world that could carry it. Was a Russian built. It had six engines. It looked like a pregnant 747.
Hmm.
And then this was trucked down to Texas, and they wanted to keep it rather quiet, but it's hard to keep something like that quiet.
Well, you're confusing me. What is this? So they're going to build a giant tunnel where they plan to run from Houston and Florida and everywhere and go down into the tunnel when this happens?
Well, it was, yeah. This is a tunnel drilling bit, and so this had to go on a very large tunnel drilling machine, and I suspect they were going to use it. It's not on display in a museum somewhere. So
they'll save NASA and save their families?
I suspect.
Are they going to let you in?
No, I haven't gotten my pass yet.
Probably not, huh?
No, but I wouldn't personally want to be in a cave myself. When one of these starts rocking and rolling, the Earth is going to fissure and fracture, and a cave underground is not the place to be. I mean, being up here is not going to be great, but I wouldn't want to be more than a couple shovelfuls of dirt away from the surface.
Hmm. So, would a couple of shovelfuls help you either?
Well, the ancients talk about being in caves.
Yes.
And so... you know, because of the wind and the rain and the severe conditions above ground...
Hmm.
But there are also, I've heard tales where people survived by laying in, you know, just in surface regions. So the bottom line is, with one of these, there are no, I know people have published like safe area maps and all kinds of things.
Oh, I know.
And there is no such thing as a safe area. If you're like at the World Trade Towers, some guy was standing in the middle of the down, right in the lobby downstairs, and he was blown out the doors two blocks away and got up and was uninjured. You know, I mean, it's
All right. There was this special on the Discovery Channel not very long ago. I'm a real devotee of the Discovery Channel. And they showed what would happen if something the size of the rock that killed the dinosaurs, supposedly, were to hit Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And what actually happens, James, is that the atmosphere boils. The oceans actually boil completely out of their beds. And that water is taken up into the atmosphere. And then fire spreads around the Earth, igniting sort of the atmosphere. And the temperature on the surface of the Earth approaches that of the sun, or something like that. It was a recent documentary. and it would erase all life down to the microbial level. In fact, down into the earth quite a long way, and there would only be a sort of a small area between the heat in the center of the earth and the heat that had been coming from the surface where microbial life could survive to one day emerge and repopulate Earth with life.
Well, we've seen mass extinctions many times on this planet. And we have, for example, salt beds from ancient oceans that are miles underground. So clearly something has happened to this rock here many times in the past. We find the dinosaur beds out in Montana, Wyoming, that area and other parts of the planet that used to be lush tropical fern forests and now are just the driest, most barren place on the planet. So clearly there have been some changes. Something hitting Earth is one option, but I don't think it's the only one or probably the most frequent one. I think these large objects coming through the solar system, the other thing they can do by igniting or discharging the solar capacitors, there's a lot of energy stored there, electrical energy. And we've seen comets come by the sun before where they snap an electrical discharge off to the sun and boom, out comes a big flare. So comets can discharge the surface fusion in the sun and cause other conditions, so they don't even have to come near Earth to cause some very severe conditions on Earth and the other planets. So there's a whole myriad of things that could happen to the solar system.
Okay, so if you were in charge, instead of being who you are, if you were in some high government position and you actually had to make a decision about whether to tell the people that something like an ELE is coming or to keep your mouth shut, what would you do?
Well, I have developed what I call mega projects, and one of them is to actually, a number of them are to deal with this, where you have small population centers all over the planet which are locally prepared. Where, you know, it's not like FEMA can come out of Washington and help everybody in the country if something major happens. But this would have to be handled at a local level. Where,
well, they had
a
hard time with just New Orleans. So the whole country is going to be a big problem.
Yeah, the whole world. So you have to get people locally to become agrarian. So if they survive, they can come through this and come out the other end. But one of the things I say about people moving into caves is that what are they going to do when they come out of their cave? Eventually, all their food's going to run out, and they're going to have to come out and plant a garden.
Well, but you're talking about a NEEL, which would be a near extinction level event.
Right.
Right.
Well,
in other words, some people would live, but I mean,
right,
according to what I saw,
right,
there's a very strong possibility that not even bacteria would survive.
Right. And the other one of my what I call mega projects is to develop space colonies, which literally, I've developed a process for doing this.
Get off the planet.
Get off the planet, and there are certain people who would go for this, and in a colony would probably be, I talk about launching tubes, large carbon fiber tubes with a rocket. I've talked about the water rockets that the Russians used back in the late 80s, early 90s. They were a nuclear-powered water rocket, and they were a steam rocket, basically, but they could get these things into orbit. But launch the tubes, strap them together, build a city like the, much like the 2001 Space Odyssey, rotating tire-like or wheel-like city, and then spin these off away from Earth and have them around the solar system. Also, they would need electromagnetic shielding because the comets, when they come through, are going to be zapping everything in sight electrically. So you would need shunts and bypass circuitry, so these electric currents would not damage the...
Just to see the human race survive.
Well,
maybe.
Right.
But what would the human race do? I mean, would there probably be no chance now to reach another habitable planet, so the new home would have to be space itself, wouldn't it?
And that's part of the whole plan of habitating space rather than waiting 20 years to send one guy to the moon. I think our space program is marching completely down the wrong road. We need more science. I know all the science guys at NASA don't like me, but that's okay. I think we need a lot more science where we're really discovering what's out there, and we need a Russian type of space program, manned space program, where we learn how to live in space and actually live out there. We can't be sending Tang and McDonald's hamburgers out in little packages from Earth. These people have to sustain themselves out there long term. So all of this would be a space program that I would want to see developed. I always said that the Chinese are probably the closest to having such a space program because they got an overabundance of people. They're starting to become spacefaring, and it just takes that one little kind of change in thought where we're not just going to send one guy to orbit the Earth. We're going to send 500,000 people up there, and just like the pioneers that came across in covered wagons, they didn't know how they were going to survive, but they did.
Yeah, well, it would be worth a shot. I mean, if it was actually either that or the true end of this version of the human race.
Right.
Carefully chosen words there.
Right.
I'd love to see him give it a shot. But, you know, we're nowhere near that technology right now, are we?
Well, if we started today, or unfortunately, if we would have started 30 years ago on a program to really live in space, instead of sending onesie-twosies up there.
Yeah, you got a point.
And I've always said that our space program has been a way for corporations to make money, not to go into space. And I think that's very close to accurate. But we have to change this whole concept of going into space. And I kind of liken it to the surfboard industry, where these guys go out there and get on a surfboard and learn how to ride the waves, and nobody taught them. Nobody. There was no surfboard school. They just went and did it. And that's the way I see outer space also. And you kind of see this in the entrepreneurial spirit with Branson and the
you see, you know, a little bit of it. I it's not at a scale that I'm happy with.
Right.
We should all be doing it through government. This is one. See, you know, I don't like government in much of anything, but in terms of the space program, really only a government has the capacity and the means to do it.
It's really true. So if it becomes misdirected, then everybody loses.
On the kind of scale that we're talking about here, certainly that would be true.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And it is a vast project. Kind of like building a dam system or a hydroelectric power system and say a grid system. All of these things were managed from works projects from the government. And certainly these mega projects are the same type of thing. The only problem that I see is that every time something gets in the government, it becomes profiteering, and who gets the money and the contract and it fails for that reason.
You know, the Catholic Church, Rome, actually, you know, from Rome, they've got this observatory down in Arizona that they blew right through all kinds of environmental obstacles just magically. I guess they can do that from Rome. And they got this observatory built. And I always wondered what the hell they were, you know, what the heck they were looking for.
Right. Well, that telescope is very interesting. In fact, there was a picture of it taken by an astronomer who worked there, was put on Coast to Coast within the last 6 months.
Yeah. What do you think they're looking for?
Well, comets, very specifically. That telescope was designed to look for comets, and it was built during the Hale-Bopp era.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember a guy named Malachi Martin?
Oh, yes.
Who said that one of his statements was the Vatican wanted to know if Hale-Bopp was wormwood.
Mm-hmm.
And I know personally some of the astronomers who were hired to staff that facility, because they came from the University of Minnesota, and they were comet scientists. A comet telescope is very different from any other brand of telescope.
In what manner? How do we identify that difference?
Well, most telescopes look at planets or galaxies or little things that are somewhat bright far away. A comet is wide. Covers a wide area of the sky. It's very diffuse, low light level. The tracking is totally different because a comet does not follow planetary or scenario, any other type of orbit.
So then what? You use some version of a very wide-angle lens. You're looking at a very great deal of the sky, and that defines a telescope looking at for a comet?
Right, and so you're not trying to get down to one little...
Pinpoint.
You're trying to get this vast area of the sky, and plus you have spectral analysis points in many areas of your photographic array of the CCD.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the equipment is totally different than anything else.
So then we know they're looking for comets.
They're looking for comets. Now, what is the Vatican's interest in comets?
Well, that was going to be my question.
Well, I think we know. They are very much looking for these objects that could be of historical record importance. And they know also that there's not just one of these, that there are many. And that's what I keep talking about, is that the many Planet X objects. There's not just one of these. There could be some out there, these dark objects, as you were calling them, that come back every million years or 300,000 years. And how would we have a history of any of this?
I don't know, but, from our point of view as humans, it would only take one.
Great. And there's probably, we've seen comets come through the solar system that are pretty pretty amazing. What was it, 1886 had the Great Comet, they called it. It was seen over Europe, etc. The ancients talk about these. When you see one of these big comets raging from one end of the sky to the other in the daylight sky,
yes,
everybody's going to know that that ain't no little snowball.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Sure.
Well, we think, I guess we've been observing the sky truly scientifically for a relatively short amount of time, actually. But we think we have all these things identified. But see, space lives in millions and billions and trillions of years, while we've only been observing for a little while. So what I'm saying is we don't have all of these comets categorized. And what are the chances that one that we haven't heard about before suddenly appears and starts to grow larger and larger, basically headed in our direction?
Well, it appears that that's what happened to the ancients, and they saw that, and it's going to happen again.
Saying is we haven't seen them all come by. We don't have them all categorized at all. This is like a constant sort of barrage, and
right.
So it's not predictable, right?
Yeah, and what is amazing is why astronomers are so adamant about denying that this could ever happen.
I don't get it. I mean, there are some that are in relatively short orbits, I guess, to bring them back around, that we know about those, but then there's some in very long ones that we don't know a thing about yet, right?
Right. Well, the object Sedna is in an orbit which brings it, the closest distance is three times the distance to Pluto, and then it goes out to something like 87 times the distance to Pluto. And
I'm talking about a complete intruder, though. So,
right. Well, that's just an example.
Yeah, it is.
And what's the probability that when we found Sedna, that's the only one out there? That's the biggest one, or it's the smallest one. If you look at the statistics of, I call it the size distribution of objects, we have grain-sized stuff in the solar system and asteroids and moons and planets, and the bigger you get, the fewer there are, but outside there, that's exactly right. We don't know.
Is a rogue planet possible, a total rogue planet, and by that I mean not captured by any sun or not captured by anything, but rather as a rogue traveling through the universe?
Well, supposedly NASA has discovered some of these. And it was actually Frank Drake took this information, the Drake equation, which deals with the statistical probability of life in the universe, and they updated that equation a number of years ago based on that fact, that they were finding these rogue planets.
Last hour, we normally reserve and will this time for people to ask questions, but we've got so much material to get through. James, welcome back.
Hi, Art.
You know, you've I highlighted where you wrote about Yellowstone in here. There's a lot of people, James, concerned about Yellowstone and think something's going on there. What's going on there?
Well, interestingly enough, this about 2 weeks ago, I believe it was in Nature, the journal geologist from the USGS wrote finally an article saying that, gee, the mound had risen. And, of course, they had begun measuring this in 1996, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman out there, and she was just monitoring the lake, and it was rising.
Mm-hmm.
And almost like the Hansen event, they kind of muffled this for some time.
They did.
And finally, they posted an article just rather casually saying that, yeah, it's risen and they're looking at it and they don't know anything about it and other than there it is. But the reality is that the lake at Yellowstone has been poisoned up until, oh, a few years ago. There were fish in it and they're all dead, and the bison who
they're dead.
Would roam around the lake. It's a dead lake now.
Yeah, see, I've got to fall back again on Discovery. I depend on them. And, you know, they had this really cool show. Maybe you saw it. And it showed what would happen if an event at Yellowstone, like one that has occurred there before, were to happen. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's
right.
Like an ELE almost.
Right. In the I was driving through eastern Nebraska one time, and I picked up a brochure, and it's this dinosaur bed that they discovered of ash, where the dinosaurs are simply buried in ash, and there's no volcanoes in eastern Nebraska. So it took them a long time to figure out what volcano was responsible for this ash bed that buried these dinosaurs.
Yes.
And it turns out that it was one of the sister volcanoes of the big one that's at Yellowstone. It was, this one was actually, I believe, in Wyoming, probably 500 miles away. And it just showed the, first of all, the pyroclastic blast that comes off of these probably killed the dinosaurs in that area first. And then as they laid down, the ash fell on top of them and basically
right.
encapsulated them, dried them out, so they were perfectly preserved up to today, millions, hundreds, you know, what, 50 million years later. But the big caldera in Yellowstone has gone off in the past.
Okay, what the average person, I guess, wants to know is, I mean, I remember when the volcano in the Northwest went bulge and very little warning, and then kaboom, off she went. How much do we know about the caldera there at Yellowstone? And in other words, how much bulging can it take, does anybody know, before it goes kaboom?
Well, that's the thing. They just simply don't know. And, of course, geologists always take the conservative. It's kind of like the Planet X thing. They don't want to say anything that alarms the public, and that's a general policy.
Well, I don't know if I want to be alarmed, but I do want to know the truth. I mean,
right.
And so the truth is they really don't know, or they don't want to tell us.
Well, volcanoes are hard to predict. And, like, I'm monitoring one right now in the Popocatepetl, which is outside of Mexico City. And it could just go wham someday, or it typically, though, they'll go in rhythms, and they'll start almost like a birthing process where they start in a rhythm, and then it gets the patterns get shorter, and all of a sudden then,
yeah.
You know, you start getting the rumbling under the volcano, and then
yeah.
it goes. But they don't
yeah.
always do that.
Yeah, well, I think of Coke cans. I mean, if you pick up a Coke can and it's all bloated out, well, you just know if you pop the top on that, you're going to
yep.
get drenched, right?
That's right.
So
that's right.
It's like the bloated out Coke can, see? And I'm just wondering, there must be somebody who has measurements who can tell us, look, it has this much stress right now, and if it gets that much, it's going to blow up.
Well, there's different kinds of blowing up. There's the shield volcanoes, which just ooze, like the Hawaiian Pacific volcanoes.
Good point.
But this one, according to the USGS own numbers, is overdue by about a few hundred thousand years to go off. But there are two major things that cause volcanoes to blow. One is sulfur, high sulfur content, and we know that the Yellowstone Basin has a very high sulfur content. The other thing that makes them go off the top is water. And that's one of the mega projects that I've defined that the Earth really needs. We have to drain the water out of the basin in the caldera at Yellowstone, because if you took that amount of water and turned it into steam, if that were to drain down into a fissure, and we know that when that bulge is occurring, it's not due to lava, it's due to gases. So if that were to break and the lake would fall down into that chasm and hit the magma and blow, and you turn, you know what steam will do, it would be one of the largest volcanoes the Earth has ever seen in any kind of geological history.
And for the states adjacent to this event?
Well, it wouldn't last long, because the steam and the just the how fast that would turn to steam and blow the material all over the place, it would just be a huge mess. So we can't do anything about the sulfur content. That's locked in the ground. But what we can do is drain that water out of there. And there's a natural path out the southeast arm of the lake.
And if they drain the water, you think that will at least prevent the steam part of it?
Right. And the other part of it is the lake is becoming poisoned. So you want to get that water out of there while it's still relatively fresh water.
But if they started draining that lake, don't you think that reporters would say, hey, why are you draining that lake?
Well, it would have to be something that moving water is a big issue. But once it becomes poisoned and obviously dead,
yeah,
in a few year period, you have a problem.
Well, and, yeah, obviously. But I mean, again, wouldn't reporters say, hey, why are you draining that lake?
Right. Oh, and the answer
and
would be
what?
That we have to move that water out of there to prevent the case of it falling down into a breach in like this one of these air bubbles, which we know are under that region. And that's where the bulge is. The bulge is right under the lake.
Right, but wouldn't that be this big tip-off that, you know, something potentially really bad is about to happen, is what I guess I was getting.
Well, yeah, and there again, I don't think you'd get government agencies to spring on this idea. They would balk until the cows come home.
Yes.
But it has to be done. And that's why we get into this realm of politics. Maybe that's why the Hansen incident is so valuable, because it tells you what's going on in other areas of science, geology and planetary science.
Well, that's if that's true, it's extremely sad.
And can we allow government agencies to be in control of these when they have political agendas to not scare the people or to say things that are politically correct?
Mm-hmm.
A volcano going off in the western U.S. isn't exactly a politically correct statement.
Well, I mean, for example, last night on 60 Minutes, they pointed out that one of the Democrat administrations tried to pressure Hansen into saying that it was actually worse than it was at that time, and he wouldn't do that either. I just thought I'd throw that in for balance. So, agendas, yes, they seem to carry the day, don't they?
Right, and it's unfortunate when scientists... the other unfortunate thing is hard to get a group of scientists in a room and have them all agree.
Yes, for sure.
The global warming issue, I've always tried to insert a few things in there. One is that they are measuring temperature rise, which is not the equivalent of heat content rise. I use the example of if you take two boxes, same size, you fill them full of gaseous material, but you, say, put more water vapor in one, you can have a lower temperature in the box without the water vapor, but more heat content if you have the lower temperature in the box with water content, you can actually have more heat content in that box.
Okay.
Even though it's at a lower temperature. So temperature is not an indicator of heat content, and the greenhouse global warming scientists are using them interchangeably, and it's a totally scientifically incorrect comparison. It's too difficult for them to measure true heat content, because that would require knowing the atmospheric components like water, which holds a lot of heat.
Back to water for a second, because I'm not done with this Yellowstone thing.
Right.
I guess I want to understand if the lake fell into the broken bulge. I really do want to know what would occur in the surrounding states and to what distance this would occur. Can you estimate even?
It's hard to estimate, but we've seen very small lakes like this. For example, Mount St. Helens, let's take a good example of a volcano that blew due to both water and sulfur.
Yes.
There was probably a chasm underground that when that rumbling was going on, the breaks and the fissures were occurring, and water probably from a freshwater underground reservoir dumped down into the chasm, and that's what took the top of Mount St. Helens off. And you saw it took the top third of that mountain off in a matter of seconds and blew it 60 miles in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with Krakatoa.
But the thing about Yellowstone is you've got written down here that it would be the perhaps biggest volcanic eruption the Earth has seen in 50 million years. Now, that 50 million years, that seems like a really big explosion.
That is a big explosion. So around the surrounding states, the answer to your question is it would blow material into that 50 state or that probably 10 state region, completely surrounding the Yellowstone caldera.
And how severe would the consequences of that be for those states?
Well, it would be that would end life as we know it. I don't know if it would kill everybody. The one estimate is based on past eruptions of Yellowstone that it extended out about 500 miles.
Wow.
So that means as far as eastern Minnesota. And then, of course, the dust cloud would encircle the globe. When Mount St. Helens went off, they were selling Mount St. Helens dust from New York City in little vials.
Yes.
So that was a relatively small volcano. Now,
a lot of scientists believe that, well, I guess we know, don't we, that volcanoes actually lower the temperature on Earth because they obscure the sun to a certain degree, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so something the size of Yellowstone, 50 million years apart or so, that would throw up enough dust to probably do what?
Well, we'd go into a mini ice age. There's a good record of one, and I'm trying to think of the...
That would really screw up global warming.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the one that went off in the 1800s, it was well documented. The temperatures all around the world were measured by the British Navy in the 1800s. And I'm trying to think of the name. It's out in the Pacific there, in the, I think, like the Micronesia area. It might.
Now, do you think that global warming could conceivably get bad enough that somebody would come up with the idea of blowing Yellowstone to cool it off?
I hope not. That would be some mad science.
Well, now, there's some guys at NASA who were talking about changing the Earth's orbit. Had you heard that one?
Well, I did not hear that one. I heard
you not. They were going to move the Earth further away from the sun temporarily to deal with global warming, and then at the end of that time they were going to move it back. And the way they were going to move it was to take something like a giant I don't know, maybe a comet, some planetary something that's headed in our direction but not close enough, and then insert it in exactly the right passage of Earth to just bump us out of the current orbit by a little bit. And then the idea was to get another rock and put us back in orbit after we had cooled off.
The only problem with that I see is probably what would happen. It wouldn't go out into a farther circular orbit. We would go into an elliptical orbit, so we'd go farther and then closer.
Oh, it's a lunatic-like idea.
I wouldn't like to see somebody doing that.
But it was real. I read the story. They really thought about it.
The one I saw, they were going to cast material up in outer space, I think fine aluminum particles or something, and it would block the sun and then cause cooling.
Yeah, I bet it would cause a lot of other stuff, too.
I start to play with those kind of things and the side effects and the unknown, like anything, when you change nature, five other things that you didn't expect happen.
Inevitably.
Inevitably.
Yes. So this Yellowstone thing, it's bulging. It is, just so we know the current status, is it continuing to get to be a bigger bulge? Is that the current thinking?
Well, there again, they stopped producing the data.
Well, darn.
Somebody is probably aware of the size. I mean, we have GPS. You could drop sensors down there.
But why would they stop the data, James?
Well, the woman, I forget her name, that was publishing this up to a few years ago, was kind of silenced. And then at that point, they had data on the amount that it had risen. But you would think by now they would have a volumetric measurement where you could get exactly a daily measurement, exactly how this has grown. And
one would think.
And somebody's got that data. I bet it exists somewhere. But it didn't show up.
I mean, that's just impossible. If this is really a danger and they're doing specials on Discovery Channel and such about it, and you're telling me they were giving us the data indicating it was bulging and then the data stopped, that's very troubling, James.
It is. And there again, it's just like the Hansen incident or the issue with the Dirty Snowball Comet model. Science is not science, and it is so controlled and distorted today that you could hardly recognize it as science. Somewhere above, however, I talk about the different tiers of science. Much of what we see today is, I call, Tier 2 science. There are groups of scientists, you don't know their names or you never hear from them, they don't publish. But they have real data and real information, and it does go somewhere.
Not to us.
Not to us.
Did they give any reason why they stopped the data about the caldera bulging there?
Actually, there was a statement.
Really?
And, yeah. And I'm trying to think, but it was basically... We don't want to release this until further analysis because it may alarm the public. And
did they really say that?
I'm just trying to think exactly what it said. So, but that was what I read into it, I guess. But there was actually
they actually didn't quite say that.
Probably not.
It added up to that in your mind, though.
Yeah, it was probably some double talk of some sort. And but the reality is that the data simply is no longer available. And we know that data exists. They wouldn't stop measuring that.
You wouldn't think.
No.
Well, that's just remarkable. It would sure be fun to get hold of whatever that memo or document was. Once again, here's James McCanny. And James, this is part of the show where we turn it over to the audience. Who knows where they'll take it, but all over the place. Listen, do you want to promote your books?
Sure.
Do it.
And by the way, I remember the name of that volcano. It's Tambora.
Thank you.
1800s blew up and caused a mini ice age.
Mm.
The website, of course, is linked from the Coast to Coast web page.
Naturally.
And that's the best way to get to my site, so you get to the correct location. And
yeah, but there's people like out on the road and stuff like that, and they might go there after the link. So that said, if they wanted to get to you and they went to Google and wanted to have you come up, what would they put in?
Put J.M. McCanny, McCanney.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the top one that comes up, and all those misinformation sites of bad-mouthing me come up right underneath me. So
okay.
Pick the top one. That'll
all
be
right.
My
so
website.
You mean there's actually sites that bad-mouth you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. But it's www.jmccanneyscience.com. That's the website. And I always have a little special for the coast-to-coast audience. For people who like to use mail order. And tonight, the book we're talking about is Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, and that's kind of a long title, but it's written for the general public, so you understand how our solar system weather works and how it affects us on Earth. And that book typically retails for $35, but tonight, for the audience, that'd be $25 and that includes shipping and handling.
Boy, you really love them.
And so the address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's $25 to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. And just ask for the weather book, and we'll know what you're talking about there.
You ever sign them?
They go out from a place where I don't see them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go to a talk, like I did recently, then I sign them. But,
that's nice. All right. So somebody could find you and present you with your book, and you would then sign it.
Oh, absolutely. I've signed many of them. Just that when things come in through either the web page or, unfortunately, I have had to step out of the process of that just to, so that I could direct my attention to my research, et cetera.
Got it. All right. Here they come. International Line, you're on the air with James McKenney. Where are you, please?
Hi, my name is Mick. I'm in Winnipeg,
Canada. All right. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Art. My question is for your guest, James.
Hello.
Hi, James. Earlier in the show, you were talking about NASA importing a massive drill bit to supposedly drill out a bunker to protect them in case a comet hit.
He's talking about the drill bit.
The drill bit for tunnel drilling, and they put a big rotary machine behind this, and they just tunnel through the ground. So they make long tunnels, and this one was an extra large one.
Okay, I understand that. And that reminded me of a movie I saw called Armageddon.
Oh, yes.
Where a comet was coming, and they had this idea of sending these guys out to drill big holes in the meteor and then, like, put some nukes in there and blow it up. And I was just wondering,
yes,
is that even possible? Like, if they had a big enough spaceship to get that bit out there?
That really is a cool question. Is that kind of thing they depicted there with the size of the rock that they were trying to affect? Was that realistic from a physics point of view?
The problem is now you've got many pieces. So the question is, do you want to be hit by a bigger bullet or a shotgun?
Well, as I recall, they split it in two, and both sides went on each side of Earth and neatly missed us. Is
uh-huh.
that not a likely outcome?
Well, the problem with drilling in outer space is that there's nothing to grab onto. When we drill on Earth, you have gravity, and you can drill. But the drilling in outer space is posed a problem because there's no or relatively zero gravity on these objects.
Well, we if something was headed our way, we would try something.
Well, might think so. Well, my own solution for this is that understanding that comets' orbits are diverted by their tail drag.
Mm.
You could extend a tether out from a object like this in advance. You'd have to be...
A tether,
which is a self-reeling device. Once you get it going, it just will reel out away from the sun.
What an interesting idea.
You discharge the local solar capacitor, the material comes in, it changes the orbit of the object, and without any explosions or whatever, and you better make sure you know this is going to hit Earth, and then you spirit it away, and it misses Earth because you've changed its orbit due to the tail drag. But the physical thing you do is attach a tether to it and let it reel out away from the sun.
So therein lies the tail.
And you induce the tail, the discharge of the solar capacitor, which then creates the tail, which is drawn in and ultimately changes the orbit.
Got it. First time caller line, your turn with James McKenney. Hello.
Is this wild card line?
First time caller line, sir.
Oh, am I on?
Are you not a first time caller?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought I called the wild card line.
No,
yeah.
You called the first time caller line. You are a first time caller, right?
Okay, Art, my name
is... Are you a first-time caller?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
My name is Ken, and I'm calling from Florida.
Yes.
And I've got a question for Mr. McKenney.
Yes.
James, how are you doing?
Oh, good, Ken. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not a scientist, but I have a lot of common sense, more than I would say the average person. And what you was talking about, that lake, draining that lake for the Yellowstone Park, I forget the name of the lake.
Yellowstone Lake.
Yellowstone Lake? Okay.
Yes.
wouldn't that lake present a lot of pressure on that bulge on the bottom, the water itself?
Ah. Well, in other words, he's saying that might be keeping the bulge from going kaboom.
Right. And not only that, it might be
Well,
cooling.
No, wait a minute. That's a good one. Stop right there while you're ahead. What about that, James?
Well, that's a good question. I don't believe the lake is very deep, but certainly...
Water is heavy.
Yeah. The question is, if you know, could you induce the bulge to grow more by taking the water out? Well, there again, you'd have to look at the engineering of this.
Cause it to blow sooner if you took the water.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, that's the kind of thing I always thought, like on Star Trek, instead of having a commander that made all the decisions, sometimes the guy, that maybe is closer to the action or whatever would have the best idea. So we have to, that's great to have input like this because...
Very good, caller. You've saved us.
And also the temperature. The water, wouldn't that have a cooling effect on the molten rock that's pushing up?
Another good point.
Right.
Magma?
Well, there again, but it's going in the wrong direction. And in both of these cases, if the water is there when this thing breaks, we're in big trouble.
Right, but if we cause it to break sooner, there would be less water to
and
make...
Plus, everybody would be angry with USGS or whoever did it.
Or Jim McKenney.
I was thinking I would hate to be you and make that decision of bumping the lake out and have it blow.
I'm glad you have that input, because whenever you mess with nature, as we were saying before...
Yes.
There are side effects, and this could be one of them. So there
that was
might
a
be
good a call. It didn't sound like a good call at the beginning, but it obviously was. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with James McKenney. Hello.
Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning.
James.
Hello.
When one of these objects comes floating through, if it's sufficiently large to cause trouble, it would also be sufficiently large to, through some associated side effects, pick up a few rocks from the asteroid belt and also add to the shotgun effect, would it not?
Oh, they absolutely do, and that's part of the comet phenomenon, is the what we call the meteor stream associated with comets. And the ancients talk about this, the hail of brimstone and fire. The brimstone was the meteor streams that came in along with the oil from the comet tail, the hydrocarbons. So absolutely, it's going to be picking these up, and there's an actual physical process by which comets cause the metallic structure in, like, small rocks and pebbles to be attracted. It's called the induced electric dipole force. But absolutely, and how big an object they would pick up depends on how big the comet is. But absolutely.
So the side effect could be in itself rather horrendous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are fields of rocks. They don't know where they came from over in the Mideast. They call them rock fields. And they're literally entire vast regions of the desert that are just covered in rocks. And they have no idea where these come from. But the speculation is they come from outer space. There's a series of elliptical lakes. They're small lakes down in South Carolina, and the same thing. It appears that a big barrage of objects from outer space came in and dug these out. But there again, all we see now is the result. So obviously these things have happened in the past. And now that Schumacher Levy 9, the 21 pieces hit Jupiter, scientists have become acutely aware of these objects coming and having multiple pieces coming in at one time.
Is Jupiter our protector in that regard? In other words, it's got so much yank to it that anything of substance it would likely get us would instead be captured and eaten by Jupiter?
Yes, in a sense, that's very true. But then again, like with the Venus event, it captured something that eventually ended up where we are. So it can work both ways.
Yeah, I suppose, for example, something could also only hit the outer part of Jupiter's influence and then be thrown toward us by that.
Right.
It's like a giant billiard table, isn't it?
That's what it is. It's a giant billiard game out there, and we're just we're in a nice stable orbit, but we're the target.
Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Hi, this is Gene from Michigan.
Yes.
Hello, Gene.
I have a couple quick questions. One of them is, have we ever got a manned vehicle through the Van Allen radiation belt? Do you know?
Well, I don't personally know. I have my doubts.
Right.
But that's a problem. It's a very serious problem, and NASA's one of their major two programs. They have two programs that are coverall programs within NASA. One is called Living with a Star, and that program, the other one is called Sun-Earth Connection, but the Living with the Star program is to learn how to deal with space radiation. And one of their, they have hundreds of scientists right now trying to figure out how to safely maneuver through the Earth, near-Earth radiation belts, which are the Van Allen belts. So that is a huge ongoing issue, and a lot of people are working on it. But to answer your question, I can't personally say yes or no to that.
Wow.
Right.
All right.
The other quick question I wanted to know is, what would that radiation belt perhaps help protect us if something came at us?
Well, no, it wouldn't deflect anything particularly. In that sense, and if an object were coming to us, for example, it's extremely low density out there. The thing with the radiation belts is the speed of these particles. They're at relativistic speeds. They're zipping around out there, trapped in our magnetic field, and they're moving at extreme high velocity. So when they hit a metal spacecraft, that turns into an X-ray, and therein lies the radiation problem.
Mm-hmm. So big that you think we might not have done it?
Well, there's some problems. When NASA went to the moon, the Apollo program in the late 60s, early 70s, the only radiation they were aware of at the time were alpha and beta particles, which are actual particles that might hit somebody in their detectors, their badges that they wore. Actually, that NASA symbol on their chest was also a radiation detector. They had no X-ray detection of any kind at the time. And there's an example of when they first had the shuttle, they brought it up to about a 500-mile orbit, and the astronauts' eyes began to glow, or their eyelids, their eyebrows began to fluoresce, et cetera, and so they brought them back down very quickly.
Really?
And they never went up that far again.
Fluorescing eyebrows is very concerning.
Yeah, and the shuttle itself was fluorescing. They call it, the term is shuttle glow. So in the very early trips up there, they experienced what they call shuttle glow, which is an electrical discharge of
As an astronaut, I'd probably be willing to put up with the shuttle glowing, but I would draw the line at my eyebrows.
Eyebrows glowing.
Yeah,
when you can
absolutely
read the guy's book next to you with your eyebrows glowing.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona. I also have two questions, if possible.
Well, we'll see.
Dr. McCanny, you said earlier comets can cause surface fusion on the sun. So through the solar capacitor function in comet Tempel-1's impact, could it have been an electrical short cause, thus the sun displaying an increase in solar flare activity and or a measurable change in the heliosphere that could be responsible for our strange weather happenings on the continental U.S. with hurricanes and tornadoes?
Now, you're talking about Tempel-1, the deep impact probe hitting the comet. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Oh, okay. Any events like that, in fact, we did see a bright flash, a secondary flash, after the probe hit comet Tempel-1 nucleus. The plume of material came out, and then there was an incredible flash. And that was an electrical discharge that attached to that material as it came out. But it's so far away from the sun that any of that would have been contained within the local plasma environment of the comet nucleus. So, no, I wouldn't associate that with...
All right, we're almost out of time. Caller, second question fast.
Well, Richard Hogan is working on the release of post-comet TAMP-L1 information. He said last year would make your hair stand on end and that the imaging absence from the Deep Impact spacecraft is not due to equipment malfunction. You have any comment on that?
Oh, I was on the night with Richard July 4th when we were waiting for that data to come in, and we agreed on the air that there's something very hokey going on with the data. But absolutely, there's something missing there completely. But the photographs and the video, the series of clips, they made it into an actual video, makes it clear that that this is not a snowball. A lot of other things happened there. The spectrometer data we were talking about earlier clearly shows this is a hot, dry rock with no water. It's not producing anything that would form a comet tail, sublimating water of any kind. There's no. You have to understand, when you look at one of these comet nuclei, when the artist drew the artist conception earlier in the NASA program, expecting they expected this to look like a steam locomotive belching out water and et cetera to form the comet tail. Nothing of the sort was found.
All right, hold it right there. Once again, James McKenney. Welcome back, James. Been a wild show, huh?
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of territory,
you
Art.
Sure have. First time caller line, your turn to cover some territory with James. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, this is Roy, currently in San Antonio. Thank you, Art. And the first time I've had my radio shut off to Art Bell is now because you requested me to. And James, what I was hoping to ask was, there's rumors that are saying that NASA has been going to the Hopi Indians, asking them what the heck is going on with the weather changes. Are you able to verify or confirm that?
That's
no.
True. That's true.
Is that true, Art?
Well, no. I'm not saying it is true that it's done. It's true that the rumors are out there big time.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I cannot confirm it myself, but here's the thing with this kind of information. In public, they would never admit that, but that's the real source of information. Those people lived through it. They have handed this information down, and they're the best source of information on what's really going on.
One more question, if I may.
Go ahead.
There's also a rumor in 99 the Earth took a 3-degree tilt on its axis.
You'd think we'd know about that one.
That I can tell you personally, it did not.
It did not. Okay.
I'm an astronomer myself, and there are so many rumors that the moon is not where it's supposed to be and that the Earth is, you know, out of its orbit, et cetera. No, we're very much where we're supposed to be within any margin of error. There's small changes that go on all the time, some of which we don't totally understand, like the Chandler wobble or things like that, but no, we're where we're at, and
you brought up Chandler wobble. Can you tell me anything about that? Is it true that it has somewhat mysteriously stopped wobbling?
Well, it changes, and it's known to change. And the cause of the wobble itself is unknown. Some people believe it's due to the sloshing of the oceans in the cavities,
and occasionally even stops for a while. Is that correct?
Yes. And there's not a lot of exact data on this. It's like any geological phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
We may only have 100 years of data, and not all of that is the greatest.
Oh, that's a good point.
So where it's going and where it's been. But there again, I don't see a lot of good current data on that myself. In fact, I've looked around for that, and it's one of those topics that... there are probably some astronomers that have real good data, but I haven't personally seen it myself.
All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with James McKenney. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, my name is Jeff, and I'm from Orlando.
Yes, Jeff.
And one thing that I would have to ask James is, when these large cometary bodies come by Earth, you know, he was saying that they don't necessarily hit, and I believe that entirely. the probability is that they don't hit. But when they do come by, is that one of the factors that changes the polarity in the Earth?
Uh-huh.
You mean like the magnetic polarity?
Well, it could either be a magnetic shift or something worse, but his question is a good one. Could it precipitate such a thing?
Oh, absolutely. And when the Earth, the Earth is structured, we have the magnetic, what we call the magnetic North Pole, which is somewhat loosely coupled with the Earth, but the crust and mantle of the Earth ride over a viscous layer, which has actually been measured. It's not hypothetical. And then beneath that is the core. And this surface can slide over the lower layers, and that actually happens a lot of times during major earthquakes and plate shifting, etc. But the bottom line is you have a large object coming by. It sets up a gravitational wave, which then can shift this whole surface kind of shell over the core, and then it redistributes. During this process, the core continues to spin at the same rate and direction that it was spinning before. So, and all of this then kind of locks back together after the event. And it's very clear that our old North Pole used to be somewhere in the state of Ontario. That's why the magnetic North Pole is trying to migrate up to where the real North Pole is right now. So this really takes Earth takes a very good jarring, and so to answer your question, both the magnetic pole and the celestial pole, which is the rotational pole, can change dramatically during one of these events.
All right. So that was a yes.
Yes.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKenney.
Good morning. Is that me?
That's you.
Okay. I never can hear the east of the Rockies thing.
Where are you?
I am calling you from Canton, Ohio. My name is Paula.
Okay, Paula.
And it's a distinct pleasure to speak with both of you. James, earlier in the show, you were talking about the fact that we have not been hit by anything in how many thousands of years. Is there a distinct possibility that there has been intervention from other sources that have kept us from being hit
by
a meteor or something else?
Extraterrestrial billiard players.
Right.
Yes.
Actually, there's some good data. A friend of mine from Turkey is a head of a group over there, and they have actual footage taken by an airline pilot of an object coming in, kind of like you would see almost in the Deep Impact movie, and all of a sudden a laser beam comes out of nowhere and zaps this thing. There are three installations on Earth that we know of. That there's one in Russia, there's one in Turkey, and I'm not sure where the other one is, but that have been identified as what are believed to be ancient Earth-protecting automated sites, which can basically zap objects as they come in.
Man, every time I expect a big no from you, it turns out to be a yes. It blows me away.
So
there is evidence.
There is evidence that, yes, that someone has tried to protect this planet. The other issue is that the big ones that would come by and probably do the most damage, there's nothing available for those guys.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKenney. Morning. Hello. Going once. Going twice. Gone. International Line, you're on the air with James McKenney. Good morning.
Good morning, Art, and hi, James.
Hello.
Is it possible as a consideration to think of a nuclear weapon, possibly using ion propulsion for speed and distance, as a consideration of trying to protect the Earth from an incoming comet? I'd appreciate an answer. Thanks.
A nuclear explosion would have to be buried deep inside of an object out there to affect it, and in that case, will it in fact do something that will be beneficial? In other words, avert a dilemma. And there's a lot of study that's been done on this. There's two camps. One is don't do it because you are going to have a difficult time controlling the pieces that come out of this. In any explosion, you get lots of pieces. The movie in Hollywood broke it into two pieces, but how many times is that going to happen?
Yeah, Rarely, I guess. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Good morning.
Art and James, I'd like to ask about the abandoned super collider project in Texas, whether that could be used as an underground safety site for NASA employees.
Well,
then why are they drilling?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's a big tunnel. I'm not sure how big the cavity itself is. A lot of times the chamber is relatively small where the particles are.
I try to get my mail every day. I don't have my invitation yet.
I don't either.
Oh, damn.
I understand there's a lot of ants there. One of the problems they had with that were the red ants eating the insulation on the wires.
Sounds like a bad place to hide out.
Maybe I don't want to go.
Unless you like red ants, which I've had a few encounters with those guys.
That'd be a hell of a way to go.
That would not be good.
No.
I'd rather stay on top.
All right, caller. That it?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Art, thank you so much for being one of the elite broadcasters who are brave enough to not screen your calls.
You're welcome.
Mr. James, what I'd like to ask is, should somebody at some point choose to cool off our planet by simply rotating our orbit just a minute little bit, how will that affect the moon, and what will that do to our tides?
Well, moving the planet is going to be a big job. But say that you did it. Your question is, how would it affect our tides? It could change. Of course, there are animals. Life that is structured to those cycles in the sea and on land. So anything coupled to the moon would change. But there again, all of the species seem to be adaptable. Whether it would be critical to some, I couldn't tell you that. But
as far as water levels go, would that nullify everything that we're trying to stop as far as global warming goes?
Well, the tides are separate. They're due to the gravitational influence of the moon and the sun to a lesser degree. But anytime you start changing these things, you don't know of all of the side effects. One of the projects I had in my mega projects list was to take, when we have this increased runoff from Antarctica and Greenland, say, for example, to take that water and move it to desert areas. And so we'd have to develop ocean liners or maybe big plastic vessels you would pull behind ocean liners. It turns out that in 1991, Asia sent an entourage of ships into the Great Lakes and took 152 million gallons of Lake Superior lake water over to Asia, and they finally got it stopped.
Wow.
But it just shows you that people on this planet are starting to do large ventures to move fresh water or to accommodate needs.
I'd like your comments on the, you've heard, of course, of the space elevator.
Yes.
Is it practical? Is it possible? Could we really do it?
Well, there's a little problem in that we have a very large capacitor between the ionosphere and down here on the planet Earth.
Ah.
And if you break that capacitor, you're going to be doing more than elevating. You're going to be driving that current, as with any capacitor. If you discharge a capacitor, it's going to flow along that line.
Ah.
And I don't think many people would be going up that elevator shaft.
You think it could be a fatal charge?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Perry from Sedalia, Missouri. And I've heard you reference a lot of times the legends and myths and old texts and stuff, and I'm kind of interested in Zachariah Sitchin. And I just never heard of this. It intrigued me whenever you mentioned about Venus taking the atmosphere from Mars. I'd never heard that Venus did it and got trapped. And it also makes me think of Major Ed Dame, something that he remote viewed one time, was something to the effect of some object bouncing off the atmosphere of Mars and stripping away its atmosphere.
Oh, yes, you said that, yes.
I just was wondering if you could elaborate a little on that.
Okay.
So the reference specifically to Mars, the best reference comes from the Velikovsky books, The Worlds in Collision, Earth in Upheaval, and Ages in Chaos. And I don't know, that's probably in Worlds in Collision, but don't quote me on that. But he talks specifically about the Mars event and that Mars was a blue planet. It had a different orbit. Its orbit brought it closer to Earth prior to the event. And it had its orbit changed out to where it is now, according to the legends. But anyway, that's where you would find that information. That would be the best source.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKenney. Good morning.
Hi. Besides wanting to say that I think George had a caller of a truck driver who had a truck driver friend who had delivered something to Texas, went into a tunnel and drove for miles and miles underground before he deposited his unknown load.
Maybe into this drilled-out tunnel, huh?
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking. And okay. and the primary reason I called, it may not be the most important, which I hope I have a chance to say less. Okay, I don't know whether this is a cuckoo idea, but...
there are no cuckoo ideas.
Yeah, okay. What about the idea that the bird flu is a way to thin out the population for the known coming disaster so that the people who are going to go into the bunkers will have less trouble getting in there.
Ah, all right. Well, we'll have to hold it there. And so what about that?
I don't know. There are many beliefs regarding the bird flu. A lot of people believe that the bird flu term is actually a cover for a man-made virus that might be released amongst the public. So,
boy, we are conspiratorial son of a guns, aren't we? We really are. First time caller line. You're on with James McKenney. Hi.
Hi, this is Hal.
Yes.
My question is this: how long did it take nature to create oil?
Huh. And is it from old dinosaur carcasses?
Well, I don't care about that.
Well, I do.
I
do. So how long?
The oil literally comes from the tail of comets. When we pass through these comet tails, it might take up to a month where we actually are passing through. The ancients talk about the hail of brimstone and naphtha, the burning naphtha coming in from outer space, and that occurred at the time of the Great Flood, which also came in from the water came from outside the planet. But to answer your question, the hydrocarbons form relatively quickly in outer space, and this is a whole branch of chemistry. The water in the comet tail forms when hydrogen and oxygen molecules form the water molecule in outer space, and this is a whole branch of chemistry forming these, for example, hydrocarbon chains up to crude oil in the chemistry of oil. In general, you just have hydrocarbon chains, so methane and propane and all of these different things we break out of oil are smaller hydrocarbon chains. But the big ones, the crude oil, the black oil, is built up in outer space, and it doesn't really
take long.
Well, then
what? You're telling me then that dinosaurs were dust to dust? That's it?
They
weren't. They're not 10W30 now?
That's right.
Is that really right?
That's correct. We have oil all over the planet. We have large pools
yes.
under the ocean, and it came from outer space.
All right. And on that note, buddy, we're out of time.
Okay.
We have done it. What a blast it was, James. Thank you. And, of course, we'll have you back again, but it's been a total pleasure.
Well, Art, it's great being on your show always.
All right. You take care, my friend. That's it, folks, for now. That's really it.